Dave and Dejanovic, your morning companions for talk, analysis, and key perspectives on Utah's biggest stories. On KSL News Radio, the Tribe of Chad Daybell. Special coverage on KSL News Radio.
Our legal analyst, Greg Skordas, has been in Boise covering the trial of Chad Daybell. And in my read of his lengthy notes that he sent back to the station last night, I was sitting at home reading them, and I felt as though my takeaway was that the prosecution's opening statements weren't quite as strong as they should have been, as they could have been, weren't as impressive maybe on the jury. But Greg's going to get with us in just a moment and give us his full take.
One thing that stood out to me was that Chad, when the bodies were initially found, jumped into his car and attempted to flee, and then he stopped. And this is what's happening. We're starting to learn more about the details. And quite frankly, there are some excruciating details and very grisly to listen to. I think it speaks to just how horrific these murders were.
Greg Skordas joining us live on the line. He's our KSL legal analyst covering this trial. These two beautiful children, Tylee Ryan and J.J. Vallow, found buried in Chad Daybell's backyard. Of course, Chad married to their mother, Lori Vallow, who was convicted, serving time in prison, now down in Arizona, yet awaiting yet another trial in another case. It sounded to me from your notes, Greg, that maybe the prosecution missed the mark with opening statements.
Yeah, I may have overstated that a little bit. I was just kind of disappointed with their delivery and whatnot. But I think they have a solid case. I think it was a fair opening statement. They sort of spoiled me at Lori's case because the prosecution statement there was a little more compelling, and I expected the same. They had some glitches with their microphone. They had glitches with their PowerPoint, and it just kind of fizzled at the end. But I think they did the job that they needed to do. I think it was adequate, and they've certainly started out of the chute very well with their first witness, who is the lead detective in the case.
What stood out to you as the lead detective was walking the jury through what had happened?
I thought it was really good, Dave. Last time we started with Kay Woodcock, sort of because she had initiated the investigation and reported Tylee missing. In this case, we started with the detective, and he has been walking through the investigation. I mean, just recently, just a few minutes ago, he started going through the autopsy photos of little JJ. Oh, my word. It was gut-wrenching. They didn't publish them, thankfully, except that the jury was able to see them privately. But you could tell he was struggling with that. The detective was. You could tell that I think there were several of the jurors who looked to be tearing up. You know, it's been a tough morning because of what we're hearing right now, which is really going into the details of the bodies being found.
He's been cross-examined or at least questioned by Chad's defense attorney.
Not yet. He's been questioned. He's asked him a few questions about laying some foundation for some photographs. But no, I don't even know they're going to get to that today. This is going incredibly slow. And tomorrow is an off day, so we'll see if he even gets to that cross-examination of the detective today.
How has the jury been reacting to what they're seeing? What are your thoughts on that?
You know, the judge gave them a pad of paper and pencil, and they've been writing things down. And so that's been interesting to me to watch them. What the times that they'll write things down, it kind of gives you an impression of what they are finding to be important. I think they're attentive. They're certainly listening. Today's a lot more interesting than yesterday. Opening remarks are never that interesting, but they've been sitting up and listening to Detective Hermosillo today and seem to be liking his testimony, listening to it intently, and feeling like he's doing a very confident job.
Greg, you were describing that the defense they seem to have a problem with some of the exhibits or every photograph that was popping up. Can you walk us through what was going on with the defense?
Yeah, at the crime scene, there were a lot of photographs taken, and the defense was concerned about whether or not the detective actually took the photographs. And of course, those of us that practice law know that that's not a threshold question. It doesn't matter who took the photographs. Yeah. The question is if they're accurate. And the prosecution would say, are these accurate? He'd say, yeah. Then the defense would say, well, who took them? Who was present? How many people were there? And stuff that I thought was just clouding the issue, because they're going to come in. They're going to be admissible. And the prosecution laid the appropriate foundation. So I thought it was made it very tedious and time consuming that he was jumping in and asking the witness questions in the middle of the examination.
Well, I heard some of that and I thought great delay tactic. I'm sure that's about all it was. But it look, I mean, if they'd brought in, you know, Joe, who runs the ice cream shack down the road to take the photographs, maybe they would have had some sort of foundation there. But this is probably an evidence tech who works for the police department, or perhaps the FBI had their photographer in. I don't know for sure. But it's somebody within the law enforcement realm that steps in to take these photographs, from my experience in covering crime for 30 years. So, you know, I thought he was trying to, like, create a Perry Mason moment over that just failed.
Yeah, it miserably failed. And you're exactly right. It doesn't matter who took the photographs. And it was law enforcement. It was just one of his partners who was doing that part of it while he was gathering evidence. So one detective can't go into a crime scene like this, especially with a 4.5-acre plot of land with you know, basically a gravesite on it, and expect to do all of the work, including the photographs. So, yeah, they were admissible. They're coming in, and they did come in. And I think it drew unnecessary attention to them. I think it sort of backfired on the defense to fight that, and then the jury getting it and wondering why he's working so hard to keep it out of evidence.
How does the judge react to what almost feels like a misdirection? Is there a lot of patience from judges when this kind of stuff happens?
He's been incredibly patient, and he's been listening to the defense arguments. I mean, they've had a ton of what they call sidebars, where everybody sort of approaches the bench and they talk outside the presence of the jury. I mean, it's made it very tedious and very slow. My guess is the defense, and even today, he sort of backed off a little bit. I think that tactic isn't working. It'll slow down a little bit and it'll speed up the trial. And the judge has been patient with him so far, but the jury is not necessarily patient with that kind of approach.
Do you, Greg, do you think that I guess I could ask you who their next witness is? Do you know? And then how long do you feel like this trial is going to go?
Boy, I'll tell you, we didn't have court Tuesday. We don't have court tomorrow.
Ooh.
Monday was basically a waste of a day. Friday was a waste of a day. And so this is supposed to be a 10 to 12 week trial. I think the judge is looking forward to making it every day of that. I think that we'll have more, to answer your first question, we'll probably hear more law enforcement next week and really, really get through that crime scene in a very detailed way.
Greg Skordas, thank you for joining us. Thanks for giving us all the latest information on this case.
I want to just bring you up to date on new information out of the Iron County area, Cedar City, where we've been following this developing story all morning long about a lockdown regarding possible shots fired. We know that now SUU has come out and said there were no shots fired on campus. The police are still clearing buildings from what we know at SUU. However, the Iron County School District now saying that they have lifted their lockdown on the schools, the public schools in that area, which was, you know, elementary up to high school, went on lockdown once this incident started going down at Southern Utah University. So we're continuing to get good news that the situation is kind of tamping down there in the Cedar City area. And we'll continue to monitor what comes out of Southern Utah University for the latest. Straight ahead, Professor James Curry from the University of Utah, live on the line. We're going to ask him if Mike Johnson has a good chance of staying Speaker of the House, or Marjorie Taylor Greene and all of her antics win out. That conversation straight ahead.